I'm Terry Teachout of the Wall Street Journal.
I'm Peter Marks of the Washington Post.
And I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli, and I write for the New York Times, the New Yorker, and the Village Voice. Welcome to the 9th episode of Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America. We're hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group.
Today we're going to talk about what we like to call the small show syndrome. You know, those plays with the relatively small number of characters, a tidy little setting, often simply a living room, used to be a kitchen in many British plays, with a couch in the middle of the stage, not in the kitchen plays, and a relatively contained narrative. The small show also often clocks in at 90 intermissionless minutes. We're obviously far from the sprawling running times these days of, say, Eugene O'Neill or even Angels in America.
And I want to make clear right off the bat that this is the term is not necessarily pejorative. Like, there are really good, quote-unquote, small shows. Like, an example for me would be Amy Herzog's 4,000 Miles, which has the couch. It's a lovely, intimate show. But the fashion for these smaller-scale productions is more than a passing fad and reflects deeper changes in creative approach, in long-term programming from companies around the country, and maybe in the audience's taste. Shows that are large in scope and, dare I say, ambition have become outliers. I'm making a completely over-sweeping statement there. And as an aside, it's a little weird to me, the fat for the 90 intermissionless minutes in our era of binging like 15 hours of a TV series in a weekend. I never understand people who are like, 90 minutes, you know, like 2 hours. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? Like, you just watched like 8 hours of the Kardashians. What are you talking about? So these days it's surprising when a long play with a big cast comes down the pike. There's actually two playing in New York that just opened recently. One is the new group's production of David Rabe's three-hour-long Good for Odo, which has a cast of 14. And the other is Bruce Norris's new play, The Low Road, which says The Public, has a cast of 17, and I haven't seen it yet, but I believe it's also near 3 hours.
Seeing it tonight.
And this is the kind of scope in length and ambition and cast that has become really rare for new plays off Broadway, where these two shows are. And the shrinkage is even affecting Broadway, where you'd think they would have space and time and money. For instance, the cast of Manhattan Theater Club's upcoming revival of St. Joan has been cut from 24 to 13. So, gentlemen, like, what do you think about all this?
Well, the first thing we must point out is that small show syndrome has really been enforced more than anything else by financial considerations. For most companies, it simply costs too much to mount more than one large cast play, if that, in a season. And that inevitably conditions what playwrights write. When I started writing for the stage in 2006, the syndrome had really already set in, and it simply never occurred to me to write any other kind of play. I wanted to get things produced. On the other hand, it's just as important to remember that doing small-scale shows and small-scale revivals doesn't necessarily have to be treated as a problem. It all depends on your point of view, and St. Joan is actually a really good show to use as an example. Not only can it be done on a small scale, but it can be done on a much smaller scale than a 13-person Broadway revival. Eric Tucker's Bedlam Theater Company first made its name 6 years ago with a pair of 4-person stagings of St. Joan in Hamlet that were performed in a really grubby walk-up performance space in downtown New York. The members of the cast switched from part to part all night long, sort of like the 39 Steps, and they were so close to the audience that you could smell their sweat. I still remember what a huge impression those two productions made on me. I wrote in the Wall Street Journal that St. Joan was the most exciting George Bernard Shaw revival I've ever seen, bar none, and it still is. Now, Bedlam has a deservedly big reputation, and those two productions are touring as a package performed in rotating repertory. They're currently running in Boston. Meanwhile, Bedlam is about to produce Pygmalion at the Sheen Center in New York at the same time that Lincoln Center Theater is doing My Fair Lady. That is a very nice contrast, and it's also a testament to the potential of small cast stagings of the classics, so long as you look at small-scale production not as a problem, but as a creative opportunity.
Well, I guess my issue has more to do with the fact that so many of the new plays right now have this very sitcom-ish, I would say, set or idea going on, where you do have this single set. It's usually a living room. There's usually a couch. And there's between two and four characters. And it's not just the setting is small, but the ideas feel small. There's really no... I'm not feeling any burning fire to tell a story. And that's what I mean by small, I guess, is this small-mindedness of plays that are well-crafted because, you know, they usually got their MFA somewhere, so they know how to write. But there's absolutely no drive fueling them, and they feel very banal. So I guess small-minded is a more accurate thing. I do understand the financial impetus because, yes, it can be expensive. The costs have risen dramatically everywhere. But when it's affecting Broadway as well, I think one of the reasons that the Lucas Neath play A Doll's House Part II made it to Broadway is
you
because
said
it
that
was
with
small.
Such contempt.
Yes, I really do not like that play.
As well, she should.
And I do really like Lucas Neath's work, but that play to me was completely subpar. But you can see why it made it there. It's a small play in every single way I can think of.
I do think we're in danger here of hazardous generalities.
That's what makes this fun.
Well, those are the best kinds.
But, you know, if you go back, if I can open my classics anthology, you know, Strindberg was writing intimate plays. This is not particularly, you know, Waiting for Godot is not a sprawling play. I mean, we can go through the decades and find many pieces that are absolutely galvanizing, Crap's Last Tape, for Christ's sakes. Go back in time and you're going to find that many plays that don't necessarily need a gigantic cast.
Or three acts or...
And the other thing to remember is, the condition of the American theater really demands physically that playwrights create small casts, small syndrome kind of play, because those are the spaces that audiences are gravitating to around the country. They want to see, they want an experience in the theater that makes them feel like they are not necessarily smelling the sweat, but seeing the pores of the actors that they're paying to see. And I think of a theater like Studio Theater in Washington, which has four spaces, all of them 200 seats or less. And they pack those spaces and put on plays by young playwrights like Annie Baker or Josh Harmon, four character plays, and they are smashes. You know, not to say that that's always the case. For example, The Wolves is a big hit wherever it's going, and it's got a cast of 10 or 11, nine women plus nine kids plus the mother, I think.
It's maybe a dozen tops. Yeah,
I mean that's a fairly nice size piece, and it's being done in those intimate spaces, so you can fill them. I'm just saying that the matrix of variables here changes from story to story to story, and I don't think we should give the impression here that large plays are dead. I mean,
no,
Oslo,
no.
Oslo won
oh,
the Tony,
God.
Another
oh,
great
dear
play
God.
That won the Tony, had a large cast. So it's not, I don't think, you know, I think we have to define better the terms by which we're discussing this.
Do define what you mean by that.
Say it again.
I said, do define what you mean by that.
I think the thing that's irksome to you, Elizabeth, is that there seems to be a format that this is falling into, a formula, and formulas are anathema to critics. We automatically, we've seen it before. We feel it almost, and yes, when you see that one set story, usually often this was built around a family play. Because families are the unit of dramatic currency in the American theater. Unlike other countries, I would say, we really think
that,
of...
That is correct, yes.
So breaking that mold, I think, is is what we're talking about here. And how does one encourage companies to vary the diet? How do we not get into this idea that drama schools are in playwriting programs want to see one play like this after another?
Well, that's part of what makes Bedlam so interesting, because they have deliberately decided we're going to perform in small spaces, but we are going to have large conceptions.
Right.
And that's the key to me. I mean, when I went to Washington a couple months ago to see a scaled down version of The Skin of Our Teeth, which is one of the biggest plays in every sense that the American theater has, I was impressed by the production, but even more than that, by the ambition behind it. These are people saying, okay, we've got a small house and we don't have a lot of people, but we're going to find a way to do a really big show that people don't do, that doesn't get done because it's a big show, and we're going to make it work. And they really did. Constellation Theater.
And interestingly enough, so the flip side for me is Fiasco Theater, which is another New York company that has traveled out. They've come to Washington. They go to the West Coast. They boil down a very difficult Shakespeare play, the problem plays, if you will, and they make it work for six actors or so. That has been, for me, very rewarding to see, because you can see the minds at work, the very smart minds at work. Wrestling with the texts, right, in very scaled down productions. However, they recently did a Twelfth Night at Classic Stage, which was a larger scale production. They started bringing in more actors. And you know what? I thought it was terrible.
It was so bad.
I thought it was terrible. I thought they lost their way. First of all, it's not a play that needs to be fixed. It's a magnificent comedy in my estimation. And, you know, suddenly they were padding it in ways that weren't true to their own aesthetic and didn't enliven the story. So it really goes to, you know, what actually these actors are trained to do.
They also did themselves a disservice, because in terms of acting, I don't think the acting was up to par.
No,
acting was really poor.
Yeah.
I have very mixed feelings about their Into the Woods, which got
another
great reviews.
Sort of scaled down.
Started, I think, at the MacArthur in Princeton.
Right.
Then moved to the Laura Pell's, the Roundabouts of Broadway House. Did very well, got good reviews. And I felt really divided. Some of it was very inventive, but I always run with them into this issue of the acting limitations, I feel, of assigning yourself some plum roles that you're not quite equipped to handle. And who's the outside person who's going to say, well, maybe you shouldn't play that? Mm. It's very difficult.
So, Terry, I'm curious, do you see this as a dilemma for the theater? You know, I mean, Elizabeth sort of rolls this out as a problem, as somehow we are being sort of, you know, shoehorned into this style of production, if I'm being fair. But is it, you know, I think we need to address this as the question, is this an adjustment to the realities of producing today, or is it an aesthetic judgment by these writers who want to tell these stories in these intimate settings, in this intimate way?
I tell you frankly, I think it's at least as much an adjustment as it is an aesthetic choice. They know that if they write a play that has a cast of 15, it's probably not going to get done. And that can't help but condition your thinking. You write plays because you want to see them produced. And bear in mind that this doesn't just limit us in terms of new plays. It limits us in terms of revivals. If you look at the American theater, which goes back to a time when it was fairly cheap to do a large cast play, you find that a very significant portion of our great plays were written for casts ranging from 10 to 25 or more. I'll tell you an interesting experience I had. I had a company ask me, if you were going to direct a small cast show, what might you want to do? And I kept thinking of all the obvious choices, you know, because they were plays that I like and that I'd seen. And I thought, how do I break out of that mold? So I sat down with Dramatist Play Service's online site, which is a complete searchable catalog that you can search by parameters. And I asked it to show me every play they published for four or fewer people. What struck me immediately was that as far as the plays by well-known playwrights, I knew all of them. you very quickly exhaust the number of recognized as distinguished plays that call for very small casts. They just weren't that common prior to the present moment. I was really surprised by that. And I thought, well, all right, fine. I like some of these plays very much. But this is also the reason why we keep getting The Glass Menagerie, why we keep getting Private Lives, why we keep getting these wonderful plays that do call for very small casts. But we have seen them all. We've seen them a lot. And that just doesn't apply to drama critics. It applies to all of us. When you really start asking yourself, what's a really great play written before 1980 for three people? It starts to get thin on the ground.
Interesting. You know, it's also interesting, as you were talking, it reminded me, you know, that the inverse is true for high schools, for school productions,
right,
which want large cast shows because they want to involve as many kids as possible.
Right.
They can't, you know, contemporary pieces can't be done for the most part because they're too small.
They're the ones who keep Kaufman and Hart alive, you know?
Yes. Right. But it's interesting, the disconnect.
Yeah.
You know, these kids grow up on, like, you know, crowd scenes on stage, and then when they graduate from school, they never see it again.
There's 500 orphans in the school productions of Annie.
Yes, but that's – and in drama – you know, I would love to talk to drama school teachers about, you know, looking for something that's relevant to this generation – that has more than four characters in it.
Right. Well, it's
an interesting problem.
Well, I also want to point out that there's a gendered aspect to it because I think men are expected to write the great American play, the sprawling, you know, multi-generational, just gay fantasia.
Right.
But women are like, well, you know, write about what you know. It's the write about what you know thing. Write about the family and relationships. And I'm wondering. I'm not sure about this. I'm just you know, kind of thinking out loud here. But I wonder if this has affected women more. Where if you write, I mean, can you think of like really huge sprawling plays recently by women?
I can actually name one. It came to mind as you were talking, which was by Sarah Rule called Passion Play.
I was going to say, you know, Sarah Rule is the only one that I can.
She wrote a three-act piece. It is wild, set in three different epochs of the staging of the Mystery Cycle, a play from the Mystery Cycle, and it's. I loved it, even though it was a bit of a mess when I saw it at Arena Stage a decade ago or more. But I would say that there, you know, that immediately sprung to mind, maybe because I couldn't come up with that many.
I saw it at Irondale and it was a really bad production, so I can't really comment on the play. But you're absolutely right that it's a very rare instance of. I want to see Lynn Nottage write something really big.
Well, what are you saying? I just want to understand what Elizabeth is saying, Terry. I just want to – you're saying it's gendered. You mean you think that women are not encouraged to think grandly on the scale of a stage production?
For the same reason that women are not expected to write the great American novel.
Or direct big movies even?
Yes.
Or I'm not saying
it's
think that's
recent.
Is
I mean,
good thing, obviously.
I mean, Wonder Woman was such an outlier. I'm talking about the movie.
Well, I think we're watching that change. We're in a moment
where changing.
Where aspirations for women have altered. But, of course, they're bumping up against the financial problem. And not only it's not just affecting present-day women playwrights, but it's also taking playwrights of the past out of our repertory. I mean, how often do you see a play staged that's by Clifford Odets? And I assure you, he wrote several plays that deserve to be staged, but they all require fairly large casts. And so they don't get done other than under rare circumstances. That Lincoln Center revival a few years ago of Golden Boy was just astonishing. I thought I would go to my grave and never see a staging of Golden Boy. And this is, by the way, something that nonprofits, I think, really have a responsibility to think about the plays that are not getting done because of cast size issues and to belly up to the bar and say, okay, we're going to do these shows. We're going to do one a season because if we don't, who will?
Yeah.
It's very tricky. I mean, I don't, you know, the thing is when we talk about the small show syndrome, again, it's not necessarily small shows per se are not a bad thing. The problem is that I think we're getting into a habit of scrimping and cutting, and sometimes, not always, but sometimes cutting is dumbing down. You're losing the flavor. You're losing what makes the kind of that sprawling, immersive thing. I think what I did not like Wolf Hall, but I think that's one of the reasons people really liked it.
And conversely, I want to throw this in. You know, a small play can be a big play.
Yes.
Elizabeth and I'm sure we agree on this one. We both went at St. Anne's Warehouse to a production called Returning to Ras, directed by Thomas Ostermeyer and starring Nina Haas, with how many characters?
Just three.
That felt huge. It felt grand. It felt kind of epic. The story she told and the way it was presented said to me, you know, that you can, in very impeccable ways, make a big statement with very few people on stage.
Really,
so let's not forget that.
But also, it was a play that is not... I'm coming back to what you were saying earlier. That is very true, that I think in America, we're really stuck in the family, the kind of the family unit,
yes,
as the beginning and end of drama.
Totally.
And Returning to Rest actually is about family, but it's also much... The canvas is huge.
Right.
Right. I know, right. Elizabeth, I know you don't care for Tom Stoppard, but what you have to acknowledge is that this is a guy who, working in a subsidized theater, has taken on the biggest possible subjects on the largest possible scale.
Right.
I agree, but he's not American.
Yeah, I mean,
he's not American.
Right. We cannot but be inspired by that. In our last podcast, we were talking about Angels and the effect that it had had on subsequent generations of playwrights. And we know from the oral history of Angels that playwrights said over and over again, it inspired me to think bigger, to try things that I thought were impossible. And there you are, Peter. That's the thing. Whether your resources allow you to have four actors or 14 actors, the point is, are you treating the small cast problem as a problem or as an opportunity?
Yeah. That's well said. That's really well said. I agree with that. Do you think, are we seeing on Broadway? You know, we have, you know, Harry Potter coming to Broadway, which is a huge cast. But, you know, I mean, but that's with the expectation that, you know, people will spend any amount of money to see this two-part thing, which I think is very, you know, it's an outlier in our
It's not a play. It's an amusement park ride.
Yeah, it's fan fiction, I think. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, and the other show opening is Lobby Hero, Kenny Lonergan's four-character play starring two huge stars, Michael Cera and Chris Evans. So, you know, the range here is quite astonishing. And interestingly, when you think about it, you know, Harry Potter has no star, and Lobby Hero, the four-character play, has to have two stars to try to bring in you know, people to see it. It's,
right,
you know, well, even though it's a tiny play.
Yeah, I love Kenny Lonergan. I think Lobby Hero is a great and important play. But that we should be excited that this play, which is, how old is it, a decade old? Is just
more.
Getting,
it's
to,
more.
Yeah,
20,
getting to Broadway now. That's a hell of a thing. I mean, to me, what I see when I look at the rest of the Broadway season, it's that serious new plays don't get to Broadway, no matter what the cast size is. I mean,
That is true.
Yeah, we get small plays,
yeah,
we get revivals,
just...
and we get subsidized imported revivals, and that really speaks to the artistic ill health of Broadway.
Right, right. We have the big play is one that's 60 years. Iceman Cometh.
Right. St. Joan. I mean, these are incontestably.
I know
great
it's
plays,
embarrassing but, in a way.
You know,
it's terrible.
It's embarrassing.
The new play category this year at the Tonys will be. I don't even know what.
Well,
it will
it's going to be the children and Harry Potter
crickets.
They'll probably have to give Harry Potter two slots to fill. You know, they'll give part one and part two.
One for installment
to fill in the entire roster.
It's just incredible.
Yeah, it's,
but you know what? I'm very happy that Second Stage, which is a very established nonprofit in New York, now has a foothold on Broadway. They bought the Helen Hayes Theater. Their first production is Lobby Hero. Then they're doing a Yong Jin Lee play, Straight White Men. And that, I think to me, it's going to be, I don't know how influential it'll be, but I think hopefully it'll open some minds as to what Because people always, you know, always hear, this show is not, it's not Broadway material. It's always this whole, it's not,
right.
You know what, you never know until you see it,
right.
And how people respond to
That's
it.
That's true.
So I'm looking forward to what this is going to do.
A real consequence that has got that toehold on Broadway. I mean, as opposed to Manhattan Theater Club, which is, you know, they've used their Broadway toehold for what? They've used it basically for quite safe work and imported work and small cast work and the things we've already seen, the things we already know about. Nothing has inspired me, made me more hopeful than Second Stage is making this move. I just hope they can follow through with it.
It's nice to end this segment on a hopeful development, I think.
Yes.
But let's move on now to our hits and misses. What about you, Elizabeth? What have you liked lately?
Well, my hit with caveats is Joshua Harmon's admissions at Lincoln Center. It's at the Mitzi Newhouse, although I like to call it the Mitzi Gaynor. that's my pet name for it. Now, this is a play that's been very divisive, actually. There's been very heated reviews, pros and cons. And it's very much in line with his previous plays, Bad Jews and Significant Other, in that Admissions is a comedy tackling identity and its politics. And it's very complicated because its point of view is very shifty and unreliable. You know, there's this trend in thrillers about the unreliable narrator. And this is the same, and I think one of the reasons this play is getting the reaction it's getting is that its point of view is very slippery, and it's very hard to tell where Harmon is standing. And people like clarity, and they do not like having this very slippery angle to it. There's nobody's a clear-cut villain, and nobody's a clear-cut bad person, and nobody's a clear-cut. It's very complicated, and the play has problems, and The lead character, it's about the Jessica Hecht plays the admissions officer in a boarding school, and has to deal. She has great principles. She wants to raise the level of minority students at the school. But then, of course, when things hit home with her own son who's applying to college, gets a little complicated. Harmon is very funny writer. He has a great facility with comedy. And here, what he does, he makes some very unlikable people likable and vice versa. So you're never sure because the unlikable people say things that you may find yourself agreeing with and vice versa. I really like this kind of opaqueness of the play. And now the miss for me is the new Jordan Harrison play, The Amateurs at the Vineyard. Jordan Harrison got quite a hit with Marjorie Prime. I just don't get the appeal. To me, it's completely, it's very superficial. And The Amateurs, it is one of those over-explainy plays that make something already very obvious even more obvious. The only fun thing about it is that it's set in the Middle Ages, partly set in the Middle Ages, which is always fun. But oh my God, it's a bad show. Oh my God, it's such a bad show.
Okay.
What about you, Terry?
Well, let's talk about a miss. I'm not sure if appalled is the right word because mainly I was bored. But
I know where this is going.
Yeah, I went to Escape to Margaritaville, and I just squirmed in my seat with boredom. Look, I actually like some of Jimmy Buffett's songs. Margaritaville, in particular, is a very intelligent song. But this show is perfectly awful. The book is witless. The cast is mostly bland. I can't remember the last time. Can't remember the last time I heard so many bad jokes told end to end on a Broadway
stage. Oh my
stage.
God! The audience was like dead. They couldn't have core. They were gaping at the stage. Like
yeah.
It was like springtime for Hitler.
Yeah. The only
for 2 hours.
Thing, yeah. The only good thing to be said about this show is Lisa Howard. She plays the second banana supporting woman, and she's just as good this time around as she was in It Should Have Been You, another fifth-rate Broadway musical on which her talents were totally wasted.
I have one thing to say about that.
Yeah.
The lifted on cables to the cheeseburger stand. I mean, what the hell was that? It was only the even worse. Possibly were the buried in lava dancing life insurance agents.
Yes.
But by the way, can I just say that this is the second musical of this season with the volcano?
I wanted to twin this this piece with another musical opening soon, and I was going to make my headline Frozen Margaritaville. Yes,
well,
thank
okay,
you very much, ladies and germs.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it happens.
How does this get to Broadway? The hell does this get to Broadway?
It gets to Broadway because somebody thinks that Jimmy Buffett has a large enough fan base that they can sell tickets to people who couldn't get it to Hamilton. That's how it gets to Broadway. We'll find out.
I don't think so. I don't think his audience goes to Broadway.
I don't think they do either. But
I think they go to Branson.
We'll see.
I think they go to Branson.
So
I'm so with you on this one.
Yeah. From misses to hits, unfortunately, I haven't seen anything I liked since Good for Otto. But you know, that's about to change. We're heading into the busiest Broadway season ever. We've got shows opening right and left between now and the end of April. But instead of mentioning one of the likely standouts on Broadway, because we all know what those are, I would like to draw everybody's attention to the fact that Basil Twist's Symphonie Fantastique is coming back to here, the same theater where it ran for 2 years after its 1998 premiere. It is an amazing piece of work, a theatrical magic act that all but defies explanation, if not description. It's an abstract, wordless, hour-long puppet show performed in a 1,000-gallon tank of water, accompanied by Berlioz's Fantastic Symphony and inspired by the paintings of Kandinsky. The first time I saw it, I described it as looking like a cross between George Balanchine, Paul Klee, and Chuck Jones. If that's your Huckleberry, you know what to do.
Yeah.
What about you, Peter? What's on your dance card for the upcoming weeks?
Good question. And I'm going to throw in a mention of a piece that's going to be opening at the Mosaic Theater Company in Washington, an original musical, karaoke kind of musical, directed by Mark Brokaw, called Paper Dolls. And it's based on a small movie, an Israeli documentary, and it's the story of five gay male Filipino nurses who care for old Orthodox Jews in a nursing home in Tel Aviv, and at night, and they headline a drag show as well. Now, yes, I know it sounds a little kinky bootsy, maybe, I don't know, but I'm really sort of interested about it. It's the American premiere of this piece, and it's very unusual for a company the size of Mosaic, with talk about a company that takes risks and spends money in, you know, on larger scale productions than you would imagine for a small company on H Street in Washington.
Yeah, well, they did a show of mine. I think very highly of them.
Yes, of course, they did Satchmo at the Waldorf in their second and one of their biggest selling shows of all time. So I'm looking. That's the show I'm looking forward to in the coming weeks.
Well, for me, I think there's obviously I'm seeing Frozen next week, and then there's Mean Girls. I mean, there's lots of great stuff, but one that I'm really kind of looking forward to and / dreading is the new Lynn Nottage play. At the Public, and it's called The Mlima's Tale. And I'm saying dreading because the subject looks like I can tell I'm going to cry. The title character is an elephant.
Oh, no.
And is played by Sargon Gorja.
Oh, Fela.
Exactly, Fela. And it's about the illegal ivory trade. And I'm tearing up already. So this is why the whole looking forward, dreading thing.
I hear you.
I mean, I was a mess at War Horse. Sobbing. It was just a horror show for me.
Well, so, one of my Lynn Nottage rules is if she writes it, I go to see it.
Mm. Yeah, pretty much same here.
I know what you're saying about cruelty to animals is a very hard subject. I was crying this weekend over the dog that got locked in the bin.
Oh, God, don't even remind me of that. Well, you know, I actually consult. You know, there's a website called DoesTheDogDie.com.
Oh, God.
So if you have doubts about a movie, and I've actually, like, if there's, you know, a dog or an animal in a movie.
Oh, remember My Pal Skip?
I don't mind being spoiled. Yeah. I just, if there's a dog, and then I will go look. And if the dog dies, I'm sorry, I can't watch it.
You know that I couldn't watch Breakfast at Tiffany as a kid because they threw the cat out in the rain in the car. They kicked the cat out. You know, I was a mess. I know, it's pathetic.
I know. So I'm really dreading Lima's tail.
I have a number of friends, parents, who cannot bear to see any work of art that has to do with the suffering of children. Mm. It's really funny what gets under your skin.
Oh, yeah. No, that's
really awful. But for some reason, do we see much of that in theater? Like the stuff. I mean, it's just
question.
Not.
No, it's not a popular.
We're
going to
save that for the most depressing podcast ever.
That's a good idea.
Yay!
That's brilliant.
Well, in that case, Elizabeth, tell us something you're looking forward to that's funny.
Oh my God, I'm really looking forward to Mean Girls. I really am. From the Washington premiere is not being great, Peter.
No, mixed.
But actually, the one I'm really looking forward to is there's a new Charles Bush play, The Confession of Lily Dare. I'm always happy when there's a new Charles Bush play. The latest one, Cleopatra, a couple of years ago, was very funny. And actually, his last few plays have been at Theater for a New Audience off Broadway on First Avenue and have not been open for review.
Hmm.
Which is why I think they've been under the radar, and I don't know what the strategy is behind that.
I don't either.
But the last three or four Charles Bush play have not been open for review, and I think that's one of the reasons. I don't know. I mean, maybe we should have him on and ask him what the reasoning is behind that.
Well, we could also do it. It would be an interesting question to talk about, like, you know, who gets to decide what gets reviewed.
Right.
You know, that's a whole other issue. That's an interesting question. I didn't realize that he had so many productions that weren't being reviewed.
Yeah, I went to Cleopatra and I had to say, you know, I will not write about it. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up tweeting, you know, go see it. And that's I think that's all I said.
Right. Right.
It was very funny. Well, so I'm not sure what is going on there. But
my situation,
and that one looks particularly juicy too. So
my situation at the Journal is I'm the guy. I'm the critic. And I review all Broadway openings, and I have to fit everything in between. And it means that there are shows that I would very much like to see and write about, and I just don't have the time to do it. I offer this heartfelt plea to producers. Please don't open good shows in April. I won't see it.
Yeah, exactly. So true.
Yeah, April. But I've noticed in the past couple of years, a lot of, in New York, we're talking about New York, there's been more shows opening, off-Broadway shows opening in May. So, all right, well, let's save some stuff for next time and wrap this one up. As always, I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli.
I'm Peter Marks.
And I'm Terry Teachout. You've been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producer is the marvelous Kirby Pate. You can follow us on Twitter at 3ontheisle and write to us at 3ontheisle@gmail.com. 3ontheisle is spelled out.
And make sure you leave us fantastic ratings and reviews on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you download this podcast.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on The Isle.